Welcome to the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. On the back end of the show, we're going to be talking about something that just plagues the world today, and especially plagues this society, and it's called greed. We're going to be joined by some of the cast members from the Red Dog Squadron's new play called Greedy. It'll be a very interesting little discussion there. And before that, we'll be talking with Larry Evers, journalist with Revolution Newspaper, the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq, and the U.S. Global Agenda, and we'll be talking about what the WikiLeaks cables reveal about the nature of the U.S. war on and the occupation of Afghanistan. But first up, anybody who's been paying attention over the years may be aware that the infamous U.S. torture camp at Guantanamo, the torture chamber at Guantanamo, has begun its 10th year of existence, and with no end in sight. And we're actually going to be joined by Andy Worthington, the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. And Andy also has a new film. He's a co-director of a film called Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. And he's recently published an article called 9 Years Later, The Political Prisoners of Guantanamo. Andy, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm slightly, I'm okay, but I just flew back from the States last night, so I'm a little bit all over the place.
You know, and you fed me a line. I have to get it out. And your arms are really tired, aren't they? Yeah, it shows how old I am there. Okay. Anyway, let's jump into this. You know, it's now 2 years. You know, as I said in the beginning, it's Guantanamo's entering its 10th year. 2 years ago, Obama pledged that he was going to close Guantanamo, but it's still there. It's still functioning. Where do things stand now for the people imprisoned in Guantanamo?
Well, you know, that's the real problem. It's looking very bleak for the men still held at Guantanamo for a variety of reasons. And, you know, there are really three categories of prisoner in Guantanamo at the moment. There are ones who the government says it wants to release, but who it's still holding. There are prisoners who the government says it wants to put on trial, but is holding without putting them on trial. And there are prisoners that the government says it wants to carry on holding indefinitely without charge or trial, which, you know, I'm sure listeners will realize is exactly what the Bush administration intended when it set up Guantanamo in the first place.
You've said that the key to understanding what's going on in relation to Guantanamo today and is the 173 prisoners that remain there is a review conducted by the Guantanamo Review Task Force. How so?
Well, this was a group of about 60 career officials, lawyers. I've been describing them recently as, you know, sober and careful career officials in government departments and in the intelligence agencies who they met every week throughout 2009 to review the cases of the prisoners who were still held there and to decide what they thought should be done with them, whether they should, you know, be released, whether they should continue to be held, whether they should be put on trial. You know, I think many of us thought initially that there were only going to be two options, that they would either suggest that the prisoners were released or that they were put on trial. But they came up with this notion that it was going to be important to carry on holding 48 men indefinitely without charge or trial on the basis that they regarded them as too dangerous to release, but that the evidence against them wouldn't stand up in a court of law. Even the kangaroo court military commissions established at Guantanamo. And I think that any sane person's response to that, really honestly, would be, well, it's not evidence, is it, then? If you've got something that wouldn't stand up in a court of law, it's hearsay. We know from the history of Guantanamo, unfortunately, that what that means it is information perhaps from intelligence reports, in fact, very probably from intelligence reports, of the interrogations of prisoners, either of the prisoners themselves, in which they have implicated themselves in things that they claim that they did, or other prisoners. And the problems, as we've particularly seen in the D.C. in the district court in Washington, D.C., where the judges have been looking at the habeas petitions of the prisoners, is they've discovered time and again how much of this information was actually produced under, if not under torture, then certainly under various forms of duress. So it makes it all extremely unreliable, and it's not really at all satisfactory for people to sit back and say, the president and his team say 48 guys are too dangerous to release, but you know, hey, we can't put them on trial. I mean, it's not asking questions of this material at all, that it's not, it shouldn't be taken on face value that it's justifiable to hold them.
Now, in relation to these guys, you actually mentioned that they've come up with this new sort of unique name for detention, and they call it conditional detention, which really is reminiscent of all the kinds of different categories that the Bush administration was so, you know, adept at coming up with, all these different, you know, names for basically keeping them in jail and torturing
them. Yeah. Well, I mean, conditional detention, according to the task force, applies to a number of the men cleared for release. So, you know, we've got 173 men in Guantanamo. We've got the 48 that they say they want to carry on holding indefinitely without charge or trial. There are 89 of the men. That's over half of them that the government said it wanted to release. But 58 of those men are Yemenis. When the task force was putting together its report, it divided the Yemenis into two categories. It said 28 guys should go home immediately. The other 30 are going to be held in what they came up with out of the bag of inventions. You know, they should be held in conditional detention until the security situation improves in Yemen. Now, what happened, you know, at the time the task force was finishing its report was that, as we all remember, a Nigerian man tried to blow himself up through his underwear on a plane at Christmas Day in 2009. There was a hysterical backlash from mainly Republicans, but also from Democrats about the dangers of Yemen and the radicalization in Yemen. And the president caved immediately to this and announced a moratorium on releasing any of the Yemenis until the security situation in Yemen improved, basically was the subtext of that. So immediately these 28 men joined the other 30 men in conditional detention. Well, it's now a year since that moratorium was issued. The saber-rattling, of course, about Yemen continues, with no regard, really, to the subtleties of the difficulties of the situation in Yemen. You know, it's painted as Al-Qaeda, the terrorist nation. And so all of these men now are held in this, you know, preposterous condition of conditional detention. And effectively, if there's no end to this process, if there's no sign, as there is no sign of when, if ever, this moratorium will come to an end, then I think it's appropriate that men who are cleared for release but who are continuing to be held with no sign of when, if ever, they're going to be released are, in fact, still subjected to arbitrary detention. All the methods of securing their release have failed. And it's why I wrote recently that, you know, I think they can fairly be described now as political prisoners.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Andy Worthington. Andy's been following Guantanamo like nobody else, I think, or very few people in the world, recognizing the importance of this and continually bringing out what's going on there. He's the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. And he also has a new film that he's the co-director of a new film called Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. And he writes regularly about what is happening in Guantanamo. Now, Andy, you were talking about this, and I found it really, really compelling, your exposition of what's happening with these people, that they're just saying they have no place, they can't let them go because they're Yemenis, and because the entire, by virtue of that, they're just, their nationality has been criminalized, as you're saying, their entire country has been criminalized.
That's a good line, actually. Yeah. I haven't used that one, but I may use that in future now, Michael.
Feel free.
Their nationality has been criminalized. That's brilliant.
Oh, good. That's what I strive for here. Well, let's talk about this. I mean, when we're talking about all these people that are cleared for detention, you have the 58 Yemenis, then you have other people, and all of these people are still sitting there. I mean, it's you know, what is the explanation? Because you did a really good exposition of this thing of, you're saying that there's no countries willing to take them, but what about the responsibility that the U.S. has in relation to this?
Well, absolutely. And I mean, this has been going on, you know, from the start of the Obama administration, actually. Is that there have been a number of men. I mean, I think the figure that we're looking at is probably around 70 people that they said they wanted to release, but who couldn't be returned to their home countries because they faced the risk of torture. I mean, there is obviously some irony in that after their treatment in Guantanamo over the years. But, you know, to its credit, for the most part, the Bush administration and the Obama administration has recognized the importance of not returning people to countries where they face these kind of dangers. I mean, these are part of international treaties. And as I say, even the Bush administration recognized this. There have been attempts, and, you know, there have been actually prisoners have been sent back to countries where, you know, they subsequently disappeared or were subjected to unfair trials, but not many examples. So as a result, they had to fish around for other countries that were prepared to take them. And in fact, you know, since President Obama came into office, I think we're now up to 36 prisoners who have been sent to 15 different countries in Europe mainly, but also in other countries. People who have essentially, whether they've done it voluntarily or whether they've been pressurized in some way, or persuaded, I should say, have taken these men who have no connection with their countries, but as part of the process of helping President Obama close Guantanamo. And we saw, actually, in some of the WikiLeaks cables that were released in the last few months, quite how tawdry some of this horse trading was with some of these nations, of, you know, offering them money and offering them a meeting with President Obama. Now, there are two problems, really. One is that, you know, there are still 31 of these guys in Guantanamo, and I'm thinking that the wellspring of generosity on the part of other countries may be drying up. In which case, where do they go? They don't go anywhere. They stay there. But throughout this whole process, of course, the question that these countries have either not asked or have been asked not to mention is the fact that the United States itself has done nothing to take any single prisoner who can't be returned home. And this process really started with the Uyghurs. These are 17 Muslims from China's Xinjiang province who had fled to Afghanistan. They had nothing to do with the Taliban. They had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. In 2008, they were the first prisoners who won their habeas corpus petitions. The government abandoned all claims they were enemy combatants. The judge said, you haven't managed to find anywhere for these guys. Holding them in Guantanamo is unconstitutional. Bring them here. The Bush administration appealed. When Obama came in, the Justice Department continued appealing. The D.C. Circuit Court agreed. On various occasions, Congress has also said, no, you must not bring any cleared prisoners to the U.S. mainland. And it also turns out that White House counsel Greg Craig, a man who lost his job after about a year, but a man who was pushing for a fair and just resolution to these Guantanamo problems, was close to finalizing a plan to bring a couple of these guys to live in the D.C. area where there is a Uyghur community. And when the Republicans got wind of that and started making the usual hysterical noises, President Obama did what he also repeatedly has done and caved in on it. So, you know, I think that's a very important issue. I'm extremely disappointed that Greg Craig's plan didn't come to fruition because it would have been such a great way of puncturing the prevailing lies about the worst of the worst if a couple of nobodies who were clearly not terrorists were actually living in the United States. But I also think, you know, there's a kind of moral obligation that's been sidelined here, and I would obviously like to see people in America who care about these issues, you know, telling their government, you know, actually, I think we really should be pulling our weight here, and we should be taking a couple of these guys.
We're talking with Andy Worthington, a journalist and historian who writes regularly about what's happening with Guantanamo. Andy, you know, one of the things that actually comes up in a lot, and this is a thing I think that really stunned a lot of people, but not hard enough, I think, the idea that part of what they've actually also extended, what they've done in terms of figuring out how they're going to deal with this, is they are basically on the verge of okaying, writing into law, legalizing indefinite detention.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and the thing is that they have actually, you know, they've struggled with this since May 2009. You know, in May 2009 was when President Obama made a major national security speech, and it's when he brought indefinite detention back onto the table. It's when he brought military commissions back onto the table. So after those, you know, initial grand gestures about dealing promptly and authoritatively with this legacy, it obviously became much more complicated behind the scenes. And ever since then, they've struggled with the, you know, with their problems with these men that they think are too dangerous to release, but they can't put on trial. Now, what they're proposing is, you know, we've heard just in the last few weeks about an executive order being prepared, which would deal with the issue of these 48 men and would also give them some kind of legal-based review process to assess on some sort of regular basis, you know, how long, whether anything has changed and they can be released. All of this sounds very similar to what Bush used to do as well, because he had rather dubious review processes. But, you know, the way they're portraying it is that it's to deal specifically with the problem with that they perceive with these people in Guantanamo, that it's not part of a bigger picture, that it's not an attempt to, you know, they've resisted attempts to calls for new legislation authorizing this, and I'm very glad that they have, obviously. But I think the problem is that if they do go ahead with this, it gives a lot of encouragement to the many people in the United States in positions of power and influence who would like nothing better than to see some kind of authorized revival of the Bush administration's policies of detaining people without charge or trial. And fundamentally, you know, the whole thing since 9/11 and the Bush administration's response with this policy essentially of arbitrary detention has been to try and make it acceptable to hold people without charge or trial. And fundamentally, that cannot be allowed to happen. I think you don't have to be that paranoid or suspicious to imagine the terrible things that would happen if government officials, for a variety of reasons, started suggesting that, you know, hey, we just need to put these guys aside and it's not really, you know, it's a difficult issue. This time it's terrorism. It could be something else in future. We have to keep the law at bay. That's what the Bush administration started 9 years ago. And that's a terrible legacy that we're trying to clear up, not that we're trying to somehow continue in some way.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think you've pointed out in one of your articles, which I thought was really, really, really important, and it speaks to the idea that Obama is not merely just continuing the Bush policies, but actually is developing and extending them. And you talk about how Bush first justified the prisoners' detention using the authorization for use of military force, and that Obama continues to rely on this. And I think it's really important, and maybe this could be a question that we sort of wrap up on, this idea that here you have, and I thought this was really important, you argue that a whole section of prisoners there are actually, even if you listened to what was going on, to what the different regimes, Bush and Obama, were saying, you would still have to argue that in reality, these people should be held as prisoners of war, not as what Bush called enemy combatants and Obama has creatively engineered to be, what does he call them now?
Alien, unprivileged, enemy belligerents.
Yeah, right, exactly. He went to college, that's how come.
That's when he gets to the stage of putting them on trial in the military commissions, which he's only done in two cases, and, you know, and he's actually gone for plea deals because the trials themselves would be farcical and embarrassing. They always have been. Otherwise, they're nobodies. I mean, they don't have a name. The Obama administration carefully got rid of enemy combatants but didn't replace it with anything. Yeah, but the authorization for use of military force is the founding document that authorized the president to go after anybody he thought was involved in 9/11 or associated with it. The Supreme Court in 2004 said, yes, it does include a detention component, essentially until the end of whatever this is that we're dealing with. So this parallel world to the Geneva Conventions was established. But what's been lost throughout and was sidelined by the Bush administration and hasn't really been fully re-implemented by the Obama administration is the Geneva Conventions. It's really pretty simple. The Bush administration argued that there were people to whom the Geneva Conventions didn't apply. And there are all kinds of different definitions in the conventions about soldiers and civilians. And there are gray areas about irregular forces. But the Bush administration said, look, we think there are guys that it doesn't cover, and therefore none of it applies. And in fact, under the Geneva Conventions, everybody must be treated humanely. And that was the bit the Bush administration cut out and said, we can torture them. They have no rights as human beings anymore. Isn't that great? We're not looking at a torture regime as we were under the Bush administration. But what we've got is this hole that is still filled by the people held in Guantanamo and the laws that underpin it, that are throwing everybody off the trail of the fact that these people should be dealt with through the Geneva Conventions if they're involved in warfare. If they're involved in criminal activity, terrorist activity, then I have stated all along that federal court trials are the appropriate venue for these crimes, because that's what it is. The fundamental problem of the war on terror is that it wasn't. It was actually should have been the pursuit of criminals. But, you know, it isn't just at Guantanamo where this situation exists of these soldiers who have been, you know, mistakenly described as enemy combatants or nobodies or alien unprivileged enemy belligerents. It's that also when you look at what's happening in a military context, it appears that the Geneva Conventions have not been fully reintroduced. So in Bagram, for example, the prisoners held in Bagram are rounded up in what appears to be a fairly random manner and are then held for... They're never screened on capture to ascertain adequately, as required by the Geneva Conventions, who they are. And then at some point down the line, which seems to be at least a year after they've been held, they're given a review process which is remarkably similar to the one that Bush implemented for use at Guantanamo. And it's the one that the Supreme Court found inadequate. So, you know, where are the Geneva Conventions? That's really my fundamental question about this. And of the men who have lost their habeas corpus petitions in Guantanamo, roughly about 38 have won and 20 have now lost. And most of those guys are just insignificant foot soldiers in a military conflict in Afghanistan. They're not terrorists. So why are we not able to raise the question of what happened to the Geneva Conventions? And I'm hoping that, you know, it will be possible to raise that one, this issue this year.
Well, it's certainly one that you continue to raise, and I think it's extremely important. And as you've pointed out, for the vast majority of people stuck in Guantanamo, imprisoned in Guantanamo today, they actually could be facing 10, 20, 30, a lifetime left in prison because of all this. And Andy, I want to thank you very much for your work continuing to expose this, because you're really sticking a pin in a situation where too many people have found this too easy to just turn their heads away and pretend it doesn't exist or it's not that bad. So thank you very much for your work, man.
Well, thank you, Michael.
Okay, thanks. Talk to you again soon, man.
Okay.
Take care now. All right, we've been talking to Andy Worthington, journalist and historian, the author of Guantanamo Files, the stories of 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. He's also a co-director of the film Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo, and his most recent article is 9 years later, The Political Prisoners of Guantanamo. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Larry Everest from Revolution Newspaper. Welcome back. That was Ghetto Priest with Dungeon. All right, joining us now is Larry Everest. He's a regular guest on the show, and he's always provides a really important insight and analysis of what's going on in the world, and particularly in relation to the Middle East, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran. And Larry's a reporter for Revolution Newspaper, and we're going to be talking today about the WikiLeaks cable's revelations on U.S. crimes in Afghanistan. And you can see Larry's articles, you can read his articles in full on revcom.us. Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael.
How you doing, man?
All
right, let's jump into this right away. You make a point in your article generally, in one of your articles generally that you've just written, that way too many people give Obama a pass on this war, or at best think it may be bad, but it's somehow okay or necessary. And in some ways, there's been a conscious sanitizing of the war by the U.S. rulers, feeding the idea that it's clean and almost bloodless in a way. But you've made the point that the WikiLeaks exposures, their disclosures of all these cables, have poked a hole in that. Can you give people a sense of what was revealed about the nature of the war there?
Well, let's just take one example that I write about. February 6th, 2009, there's a night raid in Zabul province, which is just south of Kabul along the Pakistani border, and six people are killed. The CENTCOM, the U.S. Central Command, issues a press release saying these people were militants. 24 women, 45 children were protected. It makes it sound like a very, you know, cautious, careful sort of a thing. And I could find no media coverage at all in the U.S. press of this raid. Well, it turns out that the very day that this raid took place, the local provisional leaders, provincial leaders, were saying, no, these people were all civilians. This was murder. You're terrorizing people. People are running away from these night raids and hiding in caves out of fear. And then, you know, we get a cable published by WikiLeaks from the State Department February 12th that is really detailing the response of people in the local area to this and the enormous rage that it's been generated. But there were no stories in the U.S. press about this. And other WikiLeaks cable point to the same sort of night raids killing and terrorizing many, many, not just one or two people. In another cable that was published, it discussed the fact that over 200 people in Zabul fled to the mountains during one of these night raids in December.
This kind of thing, though, is not just one example. This is actually a very systematic campaign that appears to be going on there, right?
Well, exactly. You know, in July, WikiLeaks also released 92,000 military logs from the Pentagon that showed just an extraordinary level of violence against civilians, against young people, men, women, and children. For example, in the December raid that I mentioned in Zabul province that was written about by the State Department, one of the people killed was 70 years old. Another killed 80 years old. These are the kind of people being killed in these raids, and we even have the amount of civilian casualties has gone up 20% in 2010. And we also, recently, the Army has been forced to investigate a brigade in, as part of the Striker Brigade, that's had a kill team that's been going out killing innocent people for sport and cutting off body parts reminiscent of the kind of atrocities that we were all too familiar with in Vietnam.
Now, one of the things that you've actually spoken to in this article, which I thought was really interesting, is you talk about what these tactics that they're using actually reveal about how the U.S. fights. And, you know, you put that in the context of there's been a number of tactical adjustments. There's been this, you know, moving from, you know, the point about doing counterinsurgency, moving from the drones and the, you know, the sort of clean warfare that they talk about, where the military isn't on the ground and carrying out all the slaughter. They're doing it from high and unseen. But there's been, you know, there's been a commander relieved of duty. There's all this stuff that's going on. What can you say about both what this reveals? Well, about these tactical adjustments and what these tactics reveal about how the U.S. fights.
Well, one of the interesting things, and you get a sense of this from the cables, is the U.S. officials in Afghanistan are very well aware. They're not oblivious to the outrage that these raids create. I mean, some of the tribal elders in Zabul said, "We'll fight you like we fought the Soviets if you keep this up." Yet, they are compelled to continue to inflict this horrendous violence. Let's not forget the current counterinsurgency strategy was supposed to be a more humane and more, quote, people-friendly sort of approach compared to the heavy reliance on airstrikes, drone attacks, including against wedding parties that generated enormous rage in Afghanistan. Yet, what are we finding with this supposedly different kind of counterinsurgency? The same level, increasing levels of brutality and killing of the Afghan people. And I think fundamentally that points to the fact that the United States did not come to Afghanistan to liberate the Afghan people. It came to quickly defeat the Taliban, to put in place a surrogate or a U.S.-friendly regime, to lock down the country and to use it in as part of a larger geopolitical agenda of controlling the Middle East and Central Asia and defeating Islamic jihadism and so on. So this war was about U.S. strategic interests, which it continues to be about. And again, this is something else you get from the cables, not liberating the Afghan people. And so as a consequence, there is an alien occupying army in Afghanistan that is devoted to crushing any and all resistance to that occupation amidst a population with a long history of hatred of occupations. So you get this sort of these sorts of massacres and slaughters that are going on. You also have the dimension of the U.S. having put in power an Afghan government that's hated, that's both ineffective and widely hated.
Okay, and we'll talk about that in just a second. A quick reminder to listeners, you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Larry Everest, a journalist with Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And we're talking about what the WikiLeaks cables reveal about the nature of the war in Afghanistan, and what we're about to get into is the nature of the U.S. partnership with the Afghan government. So, Larry, let's talk about this government that the U.S. has put into power. It's always posed as this is a sovereign government. This is a sovereign nation. There's a sovereign government. The U.S. has been invited there. It's made a deal to come in there and bring order to the country. What do the cables reveal about the relationship between the U.S. and the Karzai regime in particular?
Well, one thing I did want to mention in relation to what we were just talking about is, you know, Vice President Joe Biden was on Meet the Press and called Julian Assange a high-tech terrorist. And one of the things that really comes through in the leaked cables is that it's the United States that's using high-tech terror, killing hundreds and hundreds of innocent Afghans. And it's doing so with the collaboration of the Karzai regime, which is really what's really striking in reading these cables is how much the Karzai regime is a creation of and beholden to the United States. For example, in December 14th, 2009, here's a routine meeting between President Karzai and Ambassador Carl Eikenberry, the U.S. ambassador. And in this meeting, they're discussing Karzai's cabinet picks. So first of all, he feels the need to discuss with the U.S. ambassador who he's going to pick in his own cabinet. There's one particular choice for the Ministry of Energy that is controversial with the U.S. So Karzai justifies his choice of Ismail Khan as the guy's name by saying, well, look, Hillary Clinton approved this. Now, why would the head of a sovereign state feel compelled to tell the U.S. ambassador, well, this pick is okay because your Secretary of State approved it? And then, of course, Eikenberry turns around and sort of calls him a liar or mistaken or whatever and says, no, Clinton didn't approve this, and then threatens Karzai that, watch yourself, we're very concerned about it. We can't give money to ministries we don't support. And we're very concerned about the money being spent in Afghanistan. In other words, if you don't do what we say, the source of funding on which your government depends is going to be cut off. So that was just, and you know, there's a lot of other examples we can get into of who's calling the shots in Afghanistan.
Well, let's talk about one in particular, which relates to the military, because this is a critical question for any state in terms of who actually controls the military. And I think it's important because one of the things that happens here is that today, in the world today, too many people do not understand what it means for the U.S. to actually be these kinds of relationships being set up, that the U.S. actually exercises its power and its exploitation and oppression of other nations and sort of works in the world through these kinds of regimes, these kinds of setups. And these are very brutal and very parasitic and very, very clear who's in charge regimes. So let's talk about the U.S. and the military, the Afghanistan military.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, that same meeting, you know, that I was talking about, the December 14th, where Karzai's checking his cabinet appointments, Admiral Mike Mullen was also at least part of this meeting, you know, the head of the Joint Chiefs. And, you know, this was also included a discussion of building up the Afghan military. And Karzai and the other Afghan official that was there said, yes, we're going to do this. We're going to help recruit. Well, helping recruit also means helping build up a force that is going to enable and join with and participate in the kind of slaughters that we're just talking about. And again, other WikiLeaks cables describe this in detail. But then it was interesting because Karzai and the defense minister said that, look, we need heavier weapons to defend ourselves and so on and so forth. And Mullen basically says, no, they're not needed now. You don't need those because you're only involved in internal counterinsurgency. You really don't have anything to do with defending Afghanistan's borders and interacting with other countries in the region. So you don't need these weapons. And from this, it's clear that they're essentially dictating the role of the Afghan military, which, as you're mentioning, is the pillar of the state. And, you know, there's a lot of talk in the press about, gee, we have to help, we, the U.S., have to help create this Afghan military and police. And it's clear from these cables that that is being formed, shaped, and directed by the United States. One of the exposures that came out in July was that up until 2008, the CIA was paying for and running the Afghan intelligence operation.
Well, you know, we have one more question, and you have about 3 or 4 minutes to answer this, so I'll ask it really quick. And that is that you talk about in your article that the nature of the relationship between the U.S. and Afghanistan and the need to conceal the real nature of this relationship are dictated and defined by the reasons the U.S. is in Afghanistan in the first place. What do you mean by that?
Well, Afghanistan is a country with a long history of opposition to foreign invasions, foreign dominations, and it's essential for the U.S. to have, and this again is talked about specifically in the cables, to have a functioning government to provide the personnel, A, to keep order and to fight the Taliban or other anti-U.S. elements throughout the country, and B, to provide a patina, the appearance of legitimacy. One of the cables talks about Afghans are enraged at the perception that they are not even in control of the military in their own country. Well, that's more than a perception. That's a reality. But the U.S. has gone to great lengths, holding elections, having, you know, different sorts of ceremonial moments, trying to create the image that there's a legitimate, independent Afghan government that reflects the will of the Afghan people. But then behind the scenes, you get Eikenberry dictating a 5-point memo about exactly what the future president of Afghanistan should be. This was shortly after the 2009 presidential election. And even before the winner had been decided, he was coming up with talking points, including what should be said in the inaugural speech. So operating through these client regimes is extremely important to the United States. It's a key mechanism through which the United States today and other imperialist powers exert actual dominance and control of these oppressed countries.
All right, Larry, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, Michael. Okay. Well, good to be with you.
All right, that was Larry Everest, and he is the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. He's also a journalist with Revolution Newspaper, and we've been talking about the WikiLeaks cables and what they reveal about the criminal nature of the U.S. war in Afghanistan and the partnership, the so-called partnership, between the Karzai regime and the U.S. imperialists. If you want to read more of Larry's work, you can check that out at www.revcom.us. That's R-E-V as in Victor, C-O-M as in Michael, .us. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with members of the cast from the new play, Greedy. So stay tuned. right, that's Chuck Brown, DC Go-Go. Yeah, money, I need money, all right? And I'm really pleased to welcome to the show two members of the cast from a new play, Greedy. And we're joined by Brad Rader and Maggie Lawson.
Hello.
Hi. Now that was Maggie and Brad. Hi.
Yeah. How's it going?
It's going good. It's going good. And I saw your play the other night. I really, really enjoyed it, although was quite disturbed by it too.
Oh,
thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Right.
And Maggie, I want you to sit as far away from me as you can, all right? Because your character was reptilian.
Yes. Okay? Yes. Yes, she is.
And I'm telling you, I'm not going to, you come anywhere closer than that, and I'm just going to move, run.
Mission accomplished.
There you go. Why don't we talk about what the play is about?
Sure. Well, if you're familiar with those kind of Nigerian email scams that were very popular, they're still popular. I still get them in our email box for Red Dog. You know, they're basically promising big returns, you know, if you do such and such, and they make it sound very dramatic that, you know, a family member is dying or, you know, their lives are in danger. This kind of uses that as a jumping off point, although this email scam is from Russia. And Maggie plays Kira, and I play Lewis, and they're siblings with a very sordid past. And she approaches him with this kind of scam she has in mind to bilk an unsuspecting doctor out of $100,000. And, you know, that's kind of one side of the stage is this household. And the other side is a more affluent family, the doctor who gets this email. And it's how these two families kind of intersect. And
it's kind of a look into what we as humans will do and how far we'll go for what we think that we want or think that we need.
Right.
And, you know, how dark into humanity, looking into the darker side of humanity.
Well, it's really interesting, too, because, Maggie, your character, actually, I mean, to me, there's a line you have that says, well, he opened the email.
Yeah.
You know, sort of, and your character justifies many, many, many things that are just...
Which I think is what's so interesting about the play, because I think as people, we do that. You think about decisions that you make that you know, don't necessarily feel right or connected, and what you do, the justification you will go through in order to make it right in your head, you know? And I think every character on some level deals with that in the play. It's just like, you know, we'll keep justifying it until we make it right, you know, in our own mind. What we're doing is right.
Right.
And fair.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's that mistaken notion of the intellect that something outside of yourself is going to bring you peace, fulfillment, happiness. And every character in the play has something that is kind of their fulfillment or what they think is going to kind of bring them joy. So,
well, you know, it also, to me, it also really highlights this, the sort of the ethos that's of the society today, where it's really what's promoted on every level, even among people who, which is interesting, even among the characters in the play who actually think that they're actually doing good, that they're, you know, and they should be, in a sense, they should be rewarded because they're actually looking to, I'm going to help this person, you know? And the thing is that there's a certain ethos in the society that's based on a lot of the parasitism, a lot of the, you know, the greed is just an expression of the intense individualism that people are put in. It's all about me and finally getting something for me that seems to be guiding the entire society today.
Absolutely. Even when you are, you know, in the play, even, I mean, you find, you know, doing these grand gestures and how you justify them are just as ego driven as they are, you know, in their being genuine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you guys have prepared a scene, so let's let listeners hear a little bit about
this. Hopefully,
prepared.
We're prepared.
come on!
Now that the play is up and running.
Right.
So this is actually the very opening of the play. First, we see kind of a very short vignette of the character of Paul driving, and then it cuts to our household.
And while he's driving, he is thinking about and sort of reading back to himself this letter that he has received, you know, this from this Russian woman, you know, claiming that she needs his help in exchange for I can say that, right?
Yeah.
For, you know, an artifact for, you know. Anyway, all right. Shall we do this? Can
sure.
Can our voices be? All right, here we go.
All right, will you hold on?
No, that's it. That is exactly what I'm saying.
To
you
me.
Have an you are an overeducated, goatee wearing Russian motherfucking computer nerd jerk, and you live on a farm and you make more money on the internet in one day than your borscht eating ugly wife and her mother who will not die will ever make farming potatoes in like a year.
Sure. But it's illegal.
No, it's not. Not to them. See, to them, illegal used to be, you know, breathing, whatever. Everything was illegal. Now they're free. Illegal means freedom to them.
Kira, the Russians have morality.
No, they don't. They really don't. See, none of them would even worry about this for a second. It is you.
Me?
Yeah, it is people like you that worry that it might be wrong or right, which is like such a bourgeois luxury.
You make me sound like
I'm
some kind of...
Oh, I know. I make you sound like the Nazi.
Dad wasn't a Nazi.
Really?
He was a scholar and a professor. He wanted to understand.
Really? Because he seemed to me like a guy who sat in his room collecting Nazi crap. You call that understanding? Most people, Lewis, they're worried about understanding food, about understanding sex, about not getting shot or arrested or tortured. I mean, come on. It's like you can't even see that the world is insane. No, it's really insane out there.
You always do
and
that.
This is just Russia, you know? Try Iraq
All
or
right,
the Sudanese.
Stop
no,
doing
do you really
that.
Think
stop.
In between gang rapes that the Sudanese would even think twice about a little email?
Kira, how can I put this in a way that I think you'll understand? It's criminal and wrong. It's bad, and you go to either jail or hell depending.
What, you never heard of Robin Hood?
These people aren't necessarily rich.
They're gambling their money on an email.
Yes, but now you're punishing them. It's already so screwed up out there, and now you want to punish them for what? For their hope?
No. No, I would never do that, Lewis. I want to punish them for their greed.
It's just, you know, you shouldn't, you know, you're talking about Iraq like you even know
no,
anything
about
Iraq.
No, this is what I learned,
Iraq.
Lewis, when I was in Russia.
You've never been
when
to
I
Russia.
When I was in Russia last March, that's how you get this. You can't just do a search for untraceable illegal email. You have to go and get it. And you know what? If the Nazi were still around, that's exactly what I would say to him. Hello, Daddy. Yeah, you can't just sit in your room, you evil, decrepit old Nazi. You have to get off of your... What, is he still in there, Lewis? Like, rotting?
When were you in Russia?
In March. Okay, all right. I met this woman, Natasha. She had this hoop thing through her forehead. She took me to a club. We met these hacker guys. You know, they're all crazy
what
about American girls, right?
What does that have to do with
girls,
anything
right?
we're
so
talking
is.
About?
Hmm? Completely anonymous email.
All right.
All right.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. We'll take care of it.
Oh, no.
It's the passion of the moment.
I didn't even think about it.
Yeah, neither did I. Like...
That's it.
I think the last radio interview we did was some kind of underground, you know.
And you could say whatever you wanted. And I didn't even, I was more worried about raising my voice in this microphone than I was about what I was saying.
That's why we, you know, we just followed Democracy Now! I was listening to in the car. It's one of the best news programs in the country. I'm so pleased that you guys carry that show.
Yeah. It's very good.
Hopefully
actually.
We're of that pedigree.
Yes, well, of course. I'll tell you, I sat in the front row of
play
when I saw it. And I was, wow. I mean, and you brought me right back into it. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And today we're talking with Maggie Lawson, who's one of the co-stars of the television series Psych, and Brad Rader, who both of whom are in a new play called Greedy, which is from playwright Carl Gajduzek. And it's directed by James Rode, who co-stars with Maggie in Psych as well. And Greedy is about all those emails you get always offering you the seemingly, you know, you get these emails talking about they'll give you like a gazillion dollars and you think, okay, this is just a scam, but somewhere in the back of your head, you're thinking, maybe, just maybe, what if you open those emails? That's what this play's about. So let's get into it. One thing here, and Maggie, I have to ask you this because for people who don't know, you actually also co-star in a really good TV series called Psych.
Thank you. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Juliet O'Hara, right?
Yes.
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 Now, your character, I just want to see, because your character is so different than the character you play in this play.
Mm-hmm.
And where did you find, I mean, like, well, let me ask you this. Have you been tempted to open one of those emails and respond?
Well, here's what's interesting. I've opened one of those emails before because I think they've gotten very crafty in how they send them out, in that they'll get into like an address of like someone in your address book. You know, it'll come from a friend, and I got one recently that said, you know, from my friend John, that said, please help me. Someone has stolen my passport and I am in another country and I can't get home. And I was like, what? And I started reading it and I was like, oh, no. This can't be this. But there is a moment of where you question just for a second, I'm like, what if it's real? What if it is real? What if he's really in danger in France? And, you know, so yeah, I, I've I have opened those emails before. I try not to open the ones that, you know, you can actually tell are from, you know, it'll actually say like a Nigerian something or whatever. Yeah.
I always like the ones that start out with "Dearest One."
Right. Okay.
They obviously know me.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so and Psyche is completely, obviously, Juliet O'Hara is this sort of happy, sunny, you know, light character, and it's a light show, This experience has just been incredible, being able to play this role. And, you know, because I probably won't, I don't really get seen for roles like this. Rarely would I get hired for a role like this in, you know, in TV or film. And that's what's so amazing about theater and amazing about Red Dog and James and, you know, sort of taking a chance.
Well, you do such a wonderful job in it. I mean, I'm really serious. It was really, really good in that.
Thank
and
you.
I was only half joking when I said, stay across that line,
okay? Yeah. All right, good.
Your character, you really bring to life someone who just, you know, it's not immoral, it's amoral. You
know? Totally, just, yeah, right? Absolutely. I'm so glad. I'm actually relieved and very happy that you feel that way.
Okay. And Brad, your character, Lewis, you know, it's interesting because you play in the midst of all of this insanity. You play probably the most stable, at least in appearance, character in the play. How did you find doing that?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say in appearance. I mean, all the characters kind of are struggling with their own demons. And, you know, he has this overwhelming sense of obligation to take care of his sister for many reasons. And, you know, in a lot of ways, his relationship with his wife, although it's very, very sweet and loving, it's codependent, you know. And so in reality, how stable is this guy? He's kind of, he regrets a lot of the decisions he's made in his life. And, you know, he's got this albatross, you know, around his neck, which is his sister. So they're all of the characters are troubled. And they're really trying to find their way and find their humanity in this piece.
And the thing is that for listeners, in this play, anything you begin to think in the beginning of the play or that you think you've got figured out by the middle of the play, everything is totally thrown up in the air by the end of the play, and it's a really great experience. All right, mm-hmm. The play is Greedy. Really great play.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
There you go. Red Dog Squadron, a really fine theater company. Okay. And I want to thank you both for joining us today, Maggie,
thank
Brad.
You.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right, well, that wraps up a show for another week. I want to thank all of my guests today, and in particular, I want to thank Andy Worthington, journalist and historian, whose work really provides a much-needed insight to and spotlight shining on one of the greatest shameful things about this society, that this system has unleashed on the people of the world, and that's the Guantanamo prison chamber, the Guantanamo torture chamber. And Andy has done just remarkably important work in making sure that we can't forget about the people whose lives have been condemned to, actually what comes down to it now, as he said, pretty much a lifetime. There's a good chance a lot of them will be spending the rest of their lives inside this infamous torture chamber. I also want to thank Larry Everest, journalist with Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. We talked with Larry about what the WikiLeaks cables reveal about the nature of the U.S. war in Afghanistan and the occupation and the so-called partnership between the Karzai regime and the U.S. imperialists. And again, I want to thank our final guests, Maggie Lawson and Brad Rader, from the cast of the new play from Red Dog Squadron. And that play is called Greedy. And boy, did you ever wonder, here's the kicker for it, did you ever wonder what might happen if you responded to one of those crazy emails that seem so phony and yet it always piques a little bit of interest in each and every one of us? Come on, admit it. Well, this play talks about what happens if you get into those emails and the greed that seems to permeate all through U.S. society today, and what's the consequences of that. I also want to thank my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and I want to thank my production assistant, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. And if you want to holler about the show, please do. Holler at me at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. You know, I want to leave you with a couple of thoughts today. Something Bob Avakian said a while back, which I think is really, the irrelevance of it and the importance of it comes up time and time again. You know, he remarked that there's a place where epistemology has to meet morality. There's a place where those two things come together. And it means basically what he was saying is that if you know something, if you understand that something is, if you know something, and you see, and you can see what it's about, you know, you can't just ignore it. You can't pretend that you don't know it, that you don't see it. And if you know something that's really bad, it's not acceptable to turn your face away from it. It's not acceptable to turn away from the need not only to oppose that, but to completely change things so this kind of stuff doesn't exist anymore. Epistemology meeting morality and what it says for human life and for all of us in general. And, you know, that sort of formed a good part of the theme of today's show. And then there's another part to that, though, that I think is just as important to add on. And that is that it's not enough to do good in a bad world. We've got to actually stand up and dedicate ourselves to changing that bad world, to completely changing it. We're going to go out now with a piece from Kris Kristofferson that I think is just really relevant to the entire theme of today's show. And that is For the Love of Money. So until next week, enjoy.
Love of money is the root of all evil. Love of money is the root of all evil. Love of money is the work of the devil. Love of money. She began running for the border and her life, like the wind, straight into the terror of the night. She survived, bargaining her body for their gold. She had to sell them was her soul. So we go. Love of money is the root of all evil. Love of money is the root of all evil. Love of money is the work of the devil. Love of money. Turn the